This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest right now? Are you feeling lonely, unappreciated, or misunderstood? When you keep these feelings bottled up, they can affect you negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's a great way to increase your self-awareness, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/beherenow.
Welcome to the Rerooted Podcast with Francesca Maxime, trauma-sensitive mindfulness meditation teacher and poet. Together, we'll take a closer look at approaches to transforming trauma with insights from psychology, neuroscience, spirituality, social justice, and the creative arts. Join Francesca and her guests for an exploration of our shared connection and how we can cultivate greater compassion for ourselves and for others. If you'd like to support Francesca and the Rerooted Podcast, please visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Francesca.
Hey, everybody. I'm Francesca Maxime. Thank you so much for joining us for this edition of the Rerooted Podcast here on Ram Dass's Be Here Now Network. And today we continue our conversations and our exploration around how to be mindful around issues of racial and social trauma and our own self-investigation work that we can do, which is kind of the mindfulness path and the Buddhist path is being able to see clearly. So what are our obscurations? What do we not know about ourselves? And where are our blind spots in these kinds of spaces, which can be kind of, a little sticky and challenging to work on. And as you can see, if you're watching it on video and not listening, I'm joined by David Dean and by Eleanor Hancock. They put together a class that they're going to tell you about that I've taken twice and run an organization called White Awake, whiteawake.org. And I have done this class twice as a light-skinned privileged or white-identified person, even though I'm of mixed ethnicity, to kind of understand where that shows up for me and what is interrogating whiteness and what is this concept of whiteness and how do we be mindful about it and how do we marry education with good intention and all these kinds of things that they're going to talk to you more about. So welcome, Eleanor and David. Thank you so much for joining me here today and our listeners on Rerooted.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Francesca.
Mm-hmm. So you're going to be offering the class again next month in October 2019, mm-hmm. And you offer it regularly throughout the year a couple of times. Tell us about the class, whoever wants to go first.
Do you want to start, David?
Sure. So,
And how you got into doing the work maybe is even a better place
to start.
And then you can talk about the class. Let's do that.
Okay.
Sure. Eleanor is obviously the director of White Awake and has put in all this work to build up that platform. And I connected with Eleanor about three and a half years ago after I had spent a lot of time working for people of color led organizations for racial justice and indigenous sovereignty and realized that even though I was doing positive work and building great relationships in those settings that I had a lot to unpack in myself and a lot more learning that I wanted to do to understand my role in creating social change in the world as a white man and understand a lot of the feelings of shame and difficulty and some of the blocks that I had while trying to do that work. And also had a lot of curiosity too about my own history and understanding what were actually the forces that set my ancestors on this path of complicity in racial harm. Eleanor and I were just in a similar place of wanting to investigate in some similar things. And so we came together and just started connecting intellectually on a number of things. And as time went on, we developed this online course called Roots Deeper Than Whiteness. One of the things that it's about that has been really powerful for me, and I'll just say a little more and let Eleanor continue, is actually seeing the connection both today and historically of racism or white supremacy and capitalism. And how so often in this anti-racist world, particularly among white people, we just look at racism in a vacuum. A lot of times we get this idea that this is just all we are, this is all we come from, this is our inherent self. And often we're debilitated with all this shame that hinders us from actually engaging productively and also keeps us from seeing our stake in a lot of this stuff. But what I think Eleanor and I have found is that when you look historically and you look today and you see the role of ruling class power and the ways in which a powerful elite have always used racism as this tool to divide and conquer and to pit masses of white folks, particularly working class white folks, against people of color to keep the two from coming together to create a better world for everyone that is both free of white supremacy and corporate domination. And if we look historically, that was that socialization is what took away many of our ethnic identities, and it's what took away many of our ancestors' radical politics.
And when you say our, just to make a demarcation, you're meaning folks who are Irish, or folks who are like, my background was Italian, or folks who are, like, you can't speak Italian at home, you have to learn English, and that kind of assimilation versus accommodation or acculturation.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the things, too, is... what I've realized is that radical politics were also stripped away in many of those situations, often preventing actually a collective struggle with people of color for a better world. And we found that that those understandings can do a lot to show us our stake and help us build really productive solidarity today.
Beautiful. Thank you, David. And I'll attest to that in the sense that you learn about how that happened with your curricula. Eleanor, please continue.
So for me, thinking about race and identity specifically started in graduate school. In the late 90s, I was at the art department working on a Master of Fine Arts degree in Madison, Wisconsin, and I ended up taking a performance art class with a Chicana professor who really focused on performance art that was taught by folks of color. And I had moved from Abilene, Texas, where I grew up, and it was just a real eye-opening experience through this, sometimes very conceptual or kind of radical genre of performance art. It was this window into the experiences of folks of color in the United States that I hadn't had before. And as I spent more time in that class, I ended up taking it several times, I began to want to understand how my identity had been shaped. And so at the time, I went to the library and this book called White Women, Race Matters. It's by a sociologist. I'm not going to say her name off the top of my head, so I won't mess it up. But it just broke down racial construction for white people and some of what was particular about that. So at that point, that was an illuminating experience for me, and it kind of set me up early on in my adult life to be conscious of race and identity. I've had some unique experiences in that I'm the mother of a biracial child. Her father's African American. So I spent a lot of time with their family, and I think it really helps when you're white if you're able to have experiences of like being a minority in a particular setting, and it's very much like traveling to another country, and you kind of learn the different cultural ways of being or how to be respectful in that space. It does shake up some of the sort of training that you've been getting, sort of consciously and unconsciously from society at large to just feel dominant in your way, it's a normal way of doing things. So I had some of those experiences. But really for me, it had always been a very personal journey. And a lot of times, you know, had to do with thinking about what my daughter's needs might be and knowing that I had different things that I was aware of than some of my other, you know, my friends who are white mothers who had white kids. I just had I had a whole other set of things that I was thinking about that they weren't thinking about. But in terms of doing work with other white people in a group setting, it had not even occurred to me that that was a thing until a few years ago, now maybe 6 years ago, seven, that I met Kristen Barker, who lives here in Washington, D.C. and participates in IMCW offerings and offers things sometimes, right?
Just for those who don't know, that's the Insight Meditation Center of Washington.
Great.
That's Tara Brock's.
Thank you. With Tara Brock.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is an outgrowth of that in a way, in some ways.
Well, yeah. So there was a group of Buddhist practitioners here in D.C. A lot of them went to IMCW Sangha events. It wasn't an IMCW group that was meeting, but there was a group of practitioners who developed their own curriculum because they wanted to understand and relate more deeply to, you know, what does it mean that we're white and we don't know that much. We don't really know as much as we'd like to know about race and how that affects us and how that affects our, you know, peers and colleagues and friends of color. And so it was a small group that met over a period of time. And at any rate, when I met Kristen, I learned about their work, and that was my first window into people doing this work. And what was really special about what they did is that they brought their mindfulness practice to it. So a lot of anti-racism training can be very intellectual. It can often be very harsh. It can be shaming and blaming. So my introduction to an approach of white people working in caucus on race was that approach already brought compassion and curiosity as the heart of mindfulness practice.
Beautiful.
And so at that point, you know, there was some collaboration that went on, and I was given permission to use the name that they had used for their small group to start a website. And then over time, the website became a platform that was able to launch an actual organization. So White Awake now has its own 501c3. We have a small board. We have an advisory council. And it's part of what's been a real blessing for me is on this journey is that it's always something I was passionate about and interested about. But as soon as I started making it the main thing that I did for work, I became this magnet for people and resources and so I've learned a lot simply because of the position that I've been in. And so now I'm kind of beginning to catch up to that point where David and I met, but there is a point for me where there was a turning point when I could fully understand that white supremacy is something that it was developed to serve the function of capitalism. It was developed by a ruling class to divide people. And what's interesting is when I first heard that concept was when I was newer to this work as group work. And there's a clip that you can find easily online. Actually, David has brought it into the Roots Deeper Than Whiteness curriculum for homework. But there's a clip of Tim Wise explaining that. When I first heard him, I was like, oh, that's just a cop-out because white people don't want to have to, like, you know, face up to their privilege and their complicity in the whole thing. So, but when I really actually got it was I was able to listen to Chris Crass give a talk in person here in DC at the Washington Ethical Society. And I just got it, you know, that this is, and that if you don't understand the function of white supremacy, then you can never unravel it. So it's very strategic. It's not about whose fault it is, you know, who's to blame. And that's part of that thinking that I think it's a very natural human thing. But once again, mindfulness is a practice, you know, it's one practice. There's many practices that can help turn you away from that, well, whose fault is it anyway, kind of thinking. It's like, and just think more about cause and effect. And if you want to unwind something, you do have to be kind of calm and centered, use your frontal cortex the way it was designed to use, and be like, well, what's happening? And so this is a huge part of the class, Roots Deeper Than Whiteness, is unwinding and understanding some of the early history around how whiteness was developed, and understanding how it was very consciously and strategically, you know, developed by a ruling class during the 13 colonies, when you had the situation where a small group of people owned everything. And there were a lot of enslaved Africans and a lot of, you know, indentured servants or European poor working people who were basically their life is, their circumstances were very similar. And so if they got together, they totally had the numbers, you know, like to overwhelm the elite. So by not only socializing white people differently, but giving them certain roles, like giving them privileges that enslaved Africans were then denied forever, and then giving them jobs to like be the slave patrol, or they consciously divided those two groups. And that is now what we're living with. And it's not just you know, something that happened in the past and, you know, we just can't get rid of it. It's actually still being used in the same way. It just adapts according to the times. So we're very much seeing that now. That's really in our face now with the Trump administration, everything that's happening right now. So, I mean, I don't, you know, I can talk a little bit more about meeting David and developing the course, but it feels like a natural point to come up for air and let you direct where the conversation goes, Francesca.
No, beautiful, beautiful. I really appreciate that. And I really appreciate your own coming into the work and how that developed and the things that you found insightful and enlightening. And I think that we all have had those moments. We haven't all had those moments. That's part of the issue. But when we have those moments, those of us who have had those moments, then it's sort of like, wow, okay, I can't like unsee this. I can't go back. Mm-hmm. It's just sort of like, oh, I didn't know. Or gee, this is what I'm not understanding.
Yeah.
So, okay, two things. I want to get to the course and sort of how it works and people, you know, can enroll and all those kinds of things. I want to get to that and we will. But I want to go back first to kind of talking about when we talk about race or racism or we talk about stuff. I mean, you very clearly laid out the argument that white privilege or white supremacy or white body supremacy or white skin privilege or light skin privilege or whatever demarcation along divisions around there being a dominant more appropriate, more, this is the exalted race or skin color or whatever, right? Like that narrative, however, you know, that came out of that false narrative, right? That fake news narrative, that came out of a really strategic economic place, right? And that was also, of course, the driving forces of slavery and everything. And that enslaved people, and also, as we know, indigenous genocide and all the other factors that came into play and other ethnic groups that were marginalized along the way. Okay, so it's economic. We get that. We know that if we're taking your argument there. But what is lost? What I'm curious about is what do white people not know? And David was talking about this, and maybe we can unpack that a little more from his side. What is lost from all the folks who did come over, who kind of worked hard, who were given the land when people of color weren't, when they were starting to come together around being poor people together and trying to, like, you know, speak their truth to be folks in power? When we had to assimilate and go into the quote unquote melting pot and wear the same kind of clothes and not eat our smelly foods and not wear our colorful, ruffly clothing and not speak in the dialect. And how does that influence perhaps the neuroses of Americans who are light-skinned privileged today, perhaps the feeling of separation that can be pervasive there and not connection and community, mindfulness communities we know as Sangha is so critical to healing and well-being, and also more of the more natural way of kind of who we are, because this is a construct. Race is a reality. Racism is a reality, but race itself is, as you said, a construct. Yeah. So, David, do you want to go there?
I have like just something that's on the tip of my tongue that I don't think will be real long. And David, I know you can speak to this really well. I mean, you know, we both can speak to this, but if you don't mind, maybe I'll just take it a little
right
short
ahead.
Turn.
Go right ahead.
And I was just talking.
That works.
There was something that you said that triggered a particular chain of thought, Francesca, that white folks were given the land. I think that one thing that's been actually part of when I met David, there was a lot of research that he had already done. And like he suggested my reading Indigenous people, the Indigenous people's history of the United States of America. There was a lot of filling in some of the gaps for me and bringing in the puzzle pieces that were missing. That was really a beautiful thing about meeting David and like being able to share in the research he had already done and talk about these things. But, you know, I think that part of the confusion that white people have when we start to address race is that we still believe that we're all one group and that we have been taught to identify with the ruling class as though we're part of it. And then when we try to break it down, we still seem to think that that's what's going on. So like, I would say that white people weren't, I mean, white people have more property ownership, it's true. But white people weren't really given land. Like, I mean, it's mixed bag because yes, they were, but they were predominantly used as a force to go out there and do the killing and claim the land and homestead it. And for the most part, they lost that land and had to keep moving. And so there's part of the experience that white people had is of being used. And I think some of the psychology, and we don't even know we've been used, and now we're in another wave of economic, you know, turning where the rich are so much richer and we can really see how everyone is struggling. Although, you know, people, there's the wealth gap and obviously, you know, white folks overall have more wealth and have more security, but no one really has the security that they need in this, you know, really divided state economically that we're in. That thought was just right on it. Hopefully that made some sense, but I'm going to pass it over to David and then I can take another turn if y'all like.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. And I guess. I was referring to more like when there were opportunities to give some land to folks that were African American, or
I didn't mean that as a correction. It was more like, oh, that just like, you know, put me somewhere. This is like a point that felt important to highlight, and it just made me think of that.
And it's a big point of the course to talk about that it's offered in the curriculum also. So
yeah,
I'm glad that you made it. And so yeah, David, continue with like, what do we give up? What's been given up?
Yeah, and I mean, a lot has been given up. Distinct. You know, like white people are not just one group historically, right? And we all have like our distinct ethnic identities, distinct histories of struggle against domination even earlier in Europe. I think what happens is so many of us have been socialized, even for the masses of Southern and Eastern European immigrants, right, in the early 1900s. In late 1800s, we talk about in the course how so many of them were put through mandatory Americanization programs where they were essentially taught that their culture was inferior and pushed to identify with this sanitized, largely false, romanticized history of the white American elite. And I think so many of us, whether we are conscious of it or not, have been pushed to identify with that. With this romanticized false narrative. And so the neuroses you were talking about to me begins to arise when, number one, when we start looking at racism, right? And when those truths are put in front of us of the reality of white supremacy and colonialism throughout this country's history, sometimes when we've completely forgotten our own stories originally, and then this is our only way of identifying this false narrative, then when that false narrative is delegitimized, we're often just like stuck in disintegration, right? In this fight, flight, or freeze space. And to me, that, you know, that's why so many people, when faced with this stuff, turn to one of those fight, flight, or freeze responses. They run away and segregate themselves from it, or they, you know, turn defensive and actually sometimes even move to the point of resisting movements for racial justice. Or like so many people sort of who are on the white anti-racist left just turn inward and sort of like feel stuck in shame and even project their shame onto all these other white people and try to be the best white person, right? But I think what the course does is that when you can reconnect to that larger narrative and understand the processes by which your ancestors were socialized and for what purposes that happened, then we can have the opportunity to actually re-identify with some of who we actually come from. We can find the opportunity to identify with multiracial movements for collective liberation that still persisted despite all this history. We can just understand our story and what actually happened, right? And come into this place of seeing that we can find strength and seeing the ways in which our stake is actually and our well-being and our security in this world of deepening economic inequality and corporate-driven climate change is actually so, also even materially, is so deeply connected and coming into solidarity with people of color. And that unlearning racism is actually a way of reconnecting to like who we actually come from, right? And unlearning racism is the key to building those coalitions that we also need to get free, right? So it's not just this guilt-ridden activity, right? Which it is in so much of, for so many people right now. Like that's like what they're driven by, honestly. And it's not, you know, productive to stay in that place. And I think we all can do so much by seeing the larger picture.
Yeah, and I so appreciate that, because I think that what happens, and I know that it happened to me too, and it's okay in other classes like yours that I had taken also, is that, you know, there are folks who get stuck in the shame spiral or in the guilt spiral or whatever, but it's good to have, like they'll say, right, mindfulness teachings will tell you, but to have a little bit of feeling bad, like that's the point of it, right? Like you want to recognize that like something's not right here, you know,
right.
But that whole piece of becoming toxic or overwhelming or mobilizing or whatever it is, like, you know, it doesn't actually do anything and it doesn't allow us to move into that space of mindful compassion and wise action and find more balance and equanimity, which if you look at the nature of things as everything's interrelated, then we naturally would be connected and we were never separate, but this sort of constant field of pushing the separation can make us feel like we're going bananas. And to reconnect for white people too, is what I'm saying, not just for those who are on the pushed into the margins. And so what I hear you saying, David, and I know from the classes, is that as we begin as white identified folks to go into looking at where this all came from economically, like Eleanor was saying, but also like, who are we really? Where did we come from? What part of Europe? What part of Italy? What part of Scotland? Yeah. What part of, you know, and what were the traditions and what was my family name? And, oh, the Highlands of, oh, the where was the, like, whatever. Right. Like, and as you learn those things, you kind of feel like, wow, like I have a place to be, right? So I can interrogate whiteness as a construct here as it presents itself alongside racism here in America today. But I can also investigate my own history and find some pride and joy there, perhaps, from that which came before, or an appreciation of the struggle that got everybody here into what now is the United States of America in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And that can actually increase our capacity for accountability, right? And racial accountability and facing our behaviors and facing those aspects of our history too, and so that's why they're not mutually exclusive. It's a huge part of that process, which I think is really powerful.
Yeah. And I'll just jump in and add a couple points here that feel, you know, relevant. They're coming up for me. One is, I think, you know, where I was trained in mindfulness was not, it's not because I'm not a practicing Buddhist, but my background in mindfulness is secular, and it comes out of the world of like cognitive behavior therapy and like looking at your life and like things in my life are not working, and your therapist might apply mindfulness or, you know, to like help you figure out what's effective. And I think that is something that's often missing in a lot of the emotional and guilt-driven activism. Is there's this feeling like, you know, white people have been privileged and white people have done these things and maybe white people should be punished or maybe we should punish ourselves or blah, 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 blah. But like, do we want to stop this? You know, do we want to take control of our lives? What's effective? What's actually going to work? And we don't really have a lot of time for some of the bitterness and arguing, you know, if we can find a way out of that and focus on something we can work on together and how our self-interest is, you know, mutual. And in that context, white people can understand some of their, they can break down some of their bias or some of their their microaggressions that have that they don't realize they're doing, but it's in relationship with people as peers who we're trying to get out of this thing together. Because at this point, it's, you know, the only thing I think that's helpful about what we're going through right now is that it's so obvious what's happening that I think we have a better chance of breaking out of it. But people have been trying to break out of this, you know, since the Roman Empire. I mean, it's been going on a long time, this, like, the empire mentality, the small group of people who are dominating masses of people and destroying the environment and destroying indigenous traditions. It's been going on so long, but understanding that we have ancestry somewhere that is connected to resistance of that, you know, something that David has touched on. The other point that I wanted to kind of bring out is that part of what changes is not just, I think that, you know, White Awake offers a whole ancestral recovery course as well that goes in even deeper to, like, well, who are your people and where are they from and how can we put that into historical context? But I think there's another part of it that, you know, some people are less attracted to that than others. And I don't feel like I think it's important to know that story, just to know something about where your people come from. But I don't think you have to understand their traditions and try to replicate that stuff. There's something else that's happened that's very immediate, that's about just being a human animal in the way that this species has evolved to live and having a connection to your body, for example, having a connection to your heart, not just living up in your head, being connected to that very natural human way of being, to empathize with others. All of these things, you know, you're interested in, like, trauma and mindfulness and how we can understand the effects of being socialized into white dominance. It disconnects us from our body. It disconnects us from our emotions. It makes it difficult to empathize with others. It sets us up to be very competitive and very intellectual, and that damages us. That damages our relationships with our family members, with our intimate partners, with our children. And it's part of how we maintain dominance. You have to deaden a person in multiple ways in order for them to be a dominant group that participates in the oppression of others, because that is not how the human animal is evolved. We are evolved where if we see somebody getting hurt, it's as if it's happening to us, and our whole being experiences that as trauma. And that's one thing, you know, that David has also researched and brought some of these concepts to me around perpetrator trauma. If you hurt someone, you then have trauma. And, you know, we often as a society, if we're stuck in that, well, it's your fault, you need to be punished. How do we unwind that? You have to actually address some of the trauma that the perpetrator has experienced. While doing what you can to keep everyone who encounters them safe. So.
Yeah, I appreciate that. David, do you have anything that you want to add there?
No, I was mostly just listening to Ellen preach.
Just because she was referencing that you were also bringing in that piece of the work, and I didn't know if that was something to talk about. So we have about 10 minutes left. So let's talk about the class itself and what people can expect, because I know, you know, Dharma teacher, mindfulness teacher, author, Ruth King, she wrote a book called Mindful of Race, which I'm sure you're familiar with. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she really encourages folks to establish what they call racial affinity groups. So that, like, you know, people who are of the same race, and in my case, she said, well, then you would want to find a mixed ethnic racial affinity group, mm-hmm. not one that's black or white or Hispanic necessarily, but people who could be Chinese and Jamaican and whatever, you know. So anyway, this class is for people who, quote unquote, identify as having light skin privilege or white skin privilege or are white identified. And talk about how that's supportive of this exploration into these issues that can be kind of thorny and sticky, and why it's what sort of people of color have been asking white or light skin privileged people to do for a long time, as opposed to having to be, as a person of color, the person who's teaching, the person with the, in this case, lighter skin, to be their teacher.
Mm-hmm. Eleanor, you want to take that?
Sure. hold on 1 minute. Uh, Yeah. So one of the things that we've, as part of our growth as an organization and offering these courses, we've realized that we need to be much more explicit about whether or not a course is a caucus and have a way of explaining that as people are registering. So if you go through the registration process, you'll see you're asked to read the ground rules for this course, and that'll include a more detailed explanation of caucusing. And actually, we reference, it's been really helpful to have the way that Ruth King writes about white about racial affinity groups is one of the best resources I've found online, honestly. And I think part of that is because she's a Dharma teacher, and it brings this thoughtful, what is strategic, compassionate approach. But basically, you know, if you're going to be in a group where you want people to be able to feel comfortable being vulnerable and to talk about their experience of how they've been socialized or their family history, and they're going to talk about the fact that they're white, you know, people are like, if you put folks in a mixed group and you ask the white people to talk about whiteness, they're going to look at the people of color. And one of two things will happen. One is if they're conscious, they're going to be self-conscious and they're going to monitor what they're saying, and you're just not going to have an honest dialogue. It's also not necessarily a helpful space and could even be a hurtful space for people of color to be in. Like, it's just, how about if you work that out yourself, you know, without me being there, witnessing it or wasting my time? The other thing that can happen is white folks, if they're brand new to the work, they can be like, you know, they haven't got any consciousness about some of the ways they've been socialized. They could be overtly hurtful to folks of color. It's just, there's no need to do that. Sometimes one of the comparisons I make is that I feel like it's a really beautiful thing when men get together and talk about how they've been socialized and into masculinity. And it would be strange. There's work that they can't do if I'm there as a woman. I might be interested in being a fly on the wall sometimes, but I don't necessarily have permission to do that. And I certainly can't tell them what they need to do because I didn't have that experience. I had the experience of being socialized as a woman and experiencing sexism and gender oppression, but I don't know the inner workings of what that's like for men. You know, men know that because they experience that. And I think that's another thing that, you know, your listeners who have a Buddhist practice or a mindfulness practice might really be able to appreciate is that inner knowing. You know, there's like, you can't have somebody from the outside tell you this is what it was like for you if they don't know that. There has to be a chance to get in touch with our inner wisdom around these things. And so, you know, I think that's part of caucusing, actually. David, do you want to elaborate on what I shared?
Yeah. And share additional stuff too. So, I mean, I also think that caucusing is one method that we use in this way. And there's also, you know, a lot of value at times in multiracial dialogue about race. And there can be, you know, if it's held right. And there's definitely value, and almost this is not supposed to be some isolated thing, but it's supposed to support people in engagement in multiracial activism. I think when you have, you know, cross-racial leadership and that represents their constituencies and everyone's coming together, and we actually can wake people up to the ways in which they're connected and even, you know, and take and create space for white folks too to take wisdom from people of color about the ways in which they have unique and extreme suffering, and we can show up for that is really important too, you know. I just want to reiterate that this is all for the purpose of greater capacity for building multiracial solidarity, because that's what we all need to create the world that we all need.
Beautiful. Yeah, I love that. And I think that, you know, again, going back to the economic piece, whether it's racial solidarity around, you know, sexual orientation, gender, whatever it is that is quote unquote being marginalized or pushed aside, right? We could extend that. But this particular course, this organization, White Awake, is focused on the racial piece. Mm-hmm. So just to note that. So we have about five more minutes, right. And I would wonder if you want to talk a little bit about the folks who, you know, taken the class and sort of some of the things that maybe they've been able to share about, like, you know, I came in with this happened, this is where I this was my light bulb moment, and then, you know, where people can enroll and how long it is and how much it costs.
We've definitely got, you know, definitely when people fill out the surveys, there's a strong impression that people put things together around the relationship between capitalism and white supremacy in a way that was new for them. And that was a really powerful experience from the course. Otherwise, I feel like there's a general sense I have that people have a really, you know, empowering experience, but I'm not pulling stuff right off the top of my head about really specific things that people have said.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that I think, and Eleanor, I think you'll agree with this too, is part of what I was talking about earlier about, and what I think this learning and stuff has done for me too, and us, is getting out of that fight, flight, or freeze space, which for many of the participants of this course, and you know, people who would take stuff like this, is almost that freeze and stuck in shame. And literally, I mean, I just led a small in-person thing out here in the Bay Area where I am, and people, after it was over, wrote things on big pieces of paper, just answering questions about kind of like different types of things they learned. And one prompt was, I used to think blank, but now I think blank. And people literally were talking about, like, they used to think that, like, they were, like, inherently evil, you know, literally, or like that this was their only heritage. Right. And, and that actually, keeps people from facing the harm, right? That keeps people, if you, and we see that in all sorts of different ways of addressing trauma, right? When you even, you know, my partner works with men in prison who've committed serious harm. And if they're stuck in their shame, and if they don't understand the forces that took them on that path, then they can't be accountable. You know, and they can't grow, and they can't see how their well-being is connected to transform.
Yeah, and I think that's why I always try to emphasize, like, you know, there's nothing wrong with you, and we're all heavily conditioned, and we have to be aware of that enough to be able to then move out of the amygdala activation and the fight, flight, freeze into sort of unpacking whatever's in our limbic, you know, sort of midbrain and all our emotional learnings and. You know, that's where the biases live, and you know, all these things that are adaptive, to be able to get more online and use that prefrontal cortex to engage in this kind of solidarity work and connective work, right? This is like, if we're feeling lonely and separated, this is the antidote. It's like, this is good for you. It's vulnerable and it's difficult, it's challenging, but you're doing it in a safe community, or as safe a community as can be created, and you're going to be able to move through it, like, have faith in that. And that is a leap of faith in a way. But it maybe feels a little better than being stuck in that shame. You know, it's really,
And people definitely have the experience of feeling connected to the community, to the other participants that are taking the course, and having this experience of, oh, I'm not alone, and I'm part of this supportive network. The other thing that often people take our courses with a small group, like other folks, you know, who they know locally, maybe other practitioners, if that's where their orientation they're coming from. We've had families actually take, like, we've had homeschooling families who are, like, on some eco village, you know, they have taken Roots Deeper with their kids. And so, you know, we really encourage that. Do you want me to talk a little bit about just registering and accessing the course? Is it time for that? When we have a registration for a course that's open, we always have that information on the homepage of our site. So you can find it in other places and on Facebook. If you follow us on Facebook, we post it there. But you can just go to whiteawake.org, and right on the homepage, you can click on a link and you can read all the information, and then you can click through and register. One of the ways that we work is that we don't limit the number of people that take a course. So we might have a lot of people taking an online course together, but when you're inside a live session, we use breakout rooms, and we have, like, some guided group discussion so that it's interactive and so that you're able to have some small group discussion. Doing it that way allows us to be in a position where we can just accept anything that a person can pay. So money should never be a barrier to taking our courses. If you want to register and can't pay anything, that's fine. We give, when you go to the registration page, we give like a basically a sliding scale registration fee, and just expecting people will pay what's comfortable for them on that fee. And then if they need to pay something different, you know, they can. And then if they want to give more, they can make a donation to the organization.
Beautiful. Such a really broad invitation, and really beautiful work that you've done. And really, the class is starting next month, October what? Six. And how long is it? And it's on Sundays for a couple hours? Or how are you doing it this time?
Yeah, it's over
yeah,
the course.
It's,
over the course of about a month and a half. It's on Sundays, I believe at 2 p.m. Western, 5 p.m. Eastern, starting October 6th. We do two Sundays in a row. Then we take a break for a week, have one more, take another break for a week, have our final one. So four sessions total.
Yeah, thanks. So it's
2 hours
right,
each.
So it's
and there's homework. We ask people to do homework in between. So you should have a little, you should have, you know, 2 or 3 hours that you can do homework in between sessions.
Well, live attendance
it really
is
enriches.
Not,
And live attendance is not mandatory. That is always a question people ask. We record the sessions and folks can use the recordings to participate. You lose a little bit of interaction of the live session, but especially if you have a small group that you're, you know, if you're part of a small group, you don't lose much because you can interact and do use the discussion prompts for the breakout groups and things like that.
All right. Starting next month, whiteawake.org, David Dean, Eleanor Hancock for doing this work. We really appreciate it. And again, you know, awakening together, really, and moving into compassionate, wise action together, and really doing the self-inquiry and interrogation around all the stuff that can occlude what prevents us from being more connected in the way that we naturally. So thank you so much for joining us today on The Rooted. Really appreciate your presence and all your good work.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for the invitation, Francesca.
Bye.
Yeah.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest right now? Are you feeling lonely, unappreciated, or misunderstood? When you keep these feelings bottled up, they can affect you negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's a great way to increase your self-awareness, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.